Okay, I think we should start. And since the Kira is having a little trouble with the internet on her end, we'll start without without a formal introduction. But I think those of you who are here know who who I am, and I'm delighted to see so many of you back here, and we'll continue with the text that we have been looking at in previous weeks. We're dealing with Parshat Mishpatim, the laws that our forefathers received right after the Ten Commandments, often known as the Covenant Code. Last week, we started reading a passage that probably in most Chumash classes, people don't spend a lot of time studying this section of the text, but we're actually going to spend two whole weeks on it. We began looking at the verses in the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim. The opening verses in the beginning of Parshat Mishpatim were about the male Hebrew slave, and then we had the female Hebrew slave. Just to review, because these issues will come up again this week, troubling assumptions that we have to make about society 3,000 plus years ago. It was understood that a man has the right to marry off his daughter before the age of majority, that she did not really have a say in the matter. The father would determine who it was that she or had the right to. It's unclear how often this happened precisely this way. We don't have survey data, but certainly there was an understanding that this is what could happen. And a man even has the right to sell his daughter. And that's what the text here is talking about that we started doing last week and that we will finish off today. Women, another assumption that is so different from our society today, women generally got married around puberty or sometimes even a little bit before puberty. And the last assumption, which will also come up today, is that polygamy is permitted throughout the ancient world as we knew it, and including among the ancient Israelites. It doesn't seem that very many people practiced polygamy, but in ancient Israelite society, but it was there on the books, and it was a possibility always that a man could take a second wife. So those are the troubling assumptions that we just have to get out there on the table in order to be able to understand the text. Now, the text that we read last week, and I highlighted four parts of the text here, four what I called interpretive cruxes, issues, that parts of the text that create some kind of level of problem, and we dealt with the first two of them last week, and we will deal with the third and the fourth this week. Okay, so just to refresh our minds about the text, when a man sells his daughter as a slave, just notice that, like, when, it doesn't say a man, it just assumes that this is something that could be happening. And here's what happens when a man sells his daughter as a slave. She shall not go free as male slaves do. And we saw a number of ways of understanding this, but the rabbinic tradition was loath to interpret it the way might be the simplest way of understanding it, which in the previous text it said that after 6 years, the male slave goes free from service. And then it says here, lo teitzei ketzei ta'avadim, she won't go free the same way that the male slaves did that we were just talking about previously. But the rabbinic tradition will have none of that and finds other ways of understanding it, including the way that Rashbam understood it, that I think is a reasonable reading of the text, saying the idea wasn't to get her into a slave kind of relationship. The idea was for her to get married. That the purchasing of this girl before puberty is because when she gets closer to puberty, she will actually marry the person who purchased her. And that's you can read the continuation of the text there in that way, and it works. If she proves to be displeasing to her master who designated her for himself, he must
let her be redeemed. So the assumption here is, the unstated assumption is that we were assuming that he would marry her, but if he changes his mind as she's growing up, he says, I don't want to marry this girl, then he should let her be redeemed by her family, let her go back to her family. He shall not have the right to sell her to outsiders since he broke faith with her. And we spent a long time looking at that text, which seems to suggest that the Hebrew makes it even stronger. As I said last week, I think that JPS toned this down by translating Am Nochri as outsiders. And the simplest understanding of Am Nochri means a non-Israelite. And the troubling aspect of this is it sounds like it's saying that the person who purchased her can't sell her to a Gentile, but the person who purchased her could sell her to somebody else, to some other Israelite. Again, halacha will have none of that. The rabbinic tradition got rid of the possibility of reading the text like that. And we spent a long time last week looking at how Ibn Ezra, who is very wedded to the plain meaning of the text, but is a loyal rabbinite Jew, how he comes up with a system to understand this. He dismisses various people who said that Am Nochri meant not an Am Nochri, but an Ish Nochri. It means another person. He thought that that was a sin against Pshat. So he came up with a way of understanding the Pshat here, and then said that the halacha that says that she cannot be resold as part of the Torah Shebaal Peh, don't look for it here in this biblical text. And we went into an aside about an important part of Ibn Ezra's system for understanding biblical texts, the idea of an asmachta, the idea that sometimes what the rabbis are doing is not interpreting the text. What they are doing is that they are attaching an oral tradition in an artificial way to a biblical verse. And he says that's what they did here. They had an oral tradition that a girl can be sold a maximum of one time. And they attached that as an asmachta. They attached it artificially to these words here, La'am nochri lo'im sholom ochra b'vigdova. Okay, all of that is just a recap of what we did last week. And now we look at the continuation of the text. Ve'im liv no'i yadena, if he designated her for his son. So the idea is when this person purchased this young girl, the possibilities were either that he would marry her or that her son, or that his son would marry her. And so if she becomes betrothed and married to the son, then he shall treat her, as is the practice with free maidens. Like, don't think of her in that slave status, even though the word ama is, it's just the female equivalent of Eved. And if we translate Eved as slave, then we should translate ama as slave. But this is saying here that if he marries her, or if his son marries her, she shouldn't be seen as a second-class wife. She should be treated kemishpat tabanot, like you treat any young woman who is getting married. Okay, and then we come to the last two verses, which we will spend all of our time on today. Imacheret yikachlo, if he marries another one, She'era kesuta ve'onata lo yigra. He must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her ona. We will talk at length about the meaning of the word ona, and so it's not to prejudice the discussion. I just left it there in the Hebrew. Ve'im shalosh eile. So that's issue number three in this text. Issue number four in this text is, Ve'im shalosh eile lo ya'aseh la v'yatze'a chinam ein kasef. Which JPS translated here as, if he fails her in these three ways. Those of you who know Hebrew would, of course, understand right away that a simpler translation of Im Shlosh Eile Lo Ya'aseh La, if he does not do these three things for her, then she shall go free without payment. Okay, so what are the three things that are being referred to here? Okay, so those are the two issues that we will look at today, and we will look at them in the opposite order. We will begin with the last issue of what does Shalosh Eileh, these three, what three are they talking about? So, as occasionally happens, so there's our issue number four, Im Shalosh Eileh. As sometimes happens about issues like this, pretty well all of the commentators say the same thing as each other. We will ask ourselves now whether this is really the plain meaning, the pshat meaning of the biblical text. But here's, I just took it from Rashbam because, you know, I'm biased for Rashbam. But Rashi says the same thing. Even Ezra says the same thing. They all explain the same way. Im shalosh eile, Rashbam writes, shelo yikachena, velo yidlivno yiyadena, velo yariach lishdota. If he fails her in these three ways. In other words, he doesn't wed her. He does not marry her off to his son. And he does not allow her to be redeemed and thus return to her nuclear family. Then she shall go free, i.e. the court will set her free. That the court, that this person who purchased this young woman, this young girl as a nama, this we're talking about somebody prepubescent in the standard understanding of this text. So I think I'll try to remember to call her a girl. Somebody who purchased this girl, there isn't a possibility of her sticking around there and just being in his house as a nama. One of three things has to happen. He marries her. He marries her off to his son. Or he returns her to her family for some token payment for some partial return of the money that he received, that he paid in the first place. If he doesn't do any of those three things, then the court is supposed to intervene and the court will set her free. So that's the standard halachic understanding. And that's so Rashbam is simply towing the line. I happened to be sitting on Emek Rephaim on a here in Jerusalem at the outdoor section of a coffee shop, and somebody walked by and said, I heard a lecture. And at the lecture, the person said that Rashbam never departs from Pshat because of rabbinic tradition. If he sees a conflict between rabbinic tradition and the pshat, he doesn't care about the conflict. He never concedes to the rabbinic tradition. Would you agree with that statement? I was trying to drink a cup of coffee peacefully, and I was accosted with this question. And I said, I would phrase it differently. I would say that Rashbam, more often than any other commentator, sticks with the plain meaning of the biblical text, even when it differs from the rabbinic tradition, but he doesn't do it all the time. And this might be one of the examples, although, you know, we could discuss what the pshat actually of this text is. So that's what Rashbam says, and that's what the Gemara says, and that's what Rashi says, and that's what Ibn Ezra says. Ibn Ezra says, Rabim chashvu, many people think that the three referred to here are be'er, ksut, ve'ona, food, clothing, and ona. Remembering again what the verse says, the second last verse here says, there are three things that he has to provide her with. He has to provide her with food, clothing, and ona. And then the next verse says, and if these three things aren't provided to her, then she goes free. See, even that, okay, so that's what Ibn Ezra says. Many people have interpreted that way. Many people think that that is the case. And Ibn Ezra says, that's impossible. That could not be the meaning of the biblical text. In my searching to find somebody from the standard tradition who said this, all I could find was Menachem Chizkuni, who wrote, Im Shlosh Eile, She'er Ksut, She'er Ksuta, Ba'unatza. This is a couple of hundred years after Ibn Ezra. Chizkuni is saying this. Chizkuni is this kind of commentary that's written in telegraphies that very rarely goes into any detail about something. So he just says, oh, the three things here, they're She'er Ksut, Ba'unatza. That sometimes Chizkuni is very into pshat, and sometimes he isn't into pshat. This might be one of the times that he was into pshat. Why is this impossible? Why does Ibn Ezra think shezeh lo yitachein? Why can't you read the text this way? Well, let's think about it in the greater context here. So the if you interpret it that way, it means it's saying, the text would be saying, okay, the first plan was that the person who purchased her would marry her. That didn't work out. The second plan is that the son would marry her, and that didn't work out. And then it says, if he marries another one, he must not withhold from this one her food and her clothing, or her ona. So she gets these three benefits. And when does she go free in Kasef? Only if those benefits were withheld from her. And in the rabbinic tradition, they don't want to consider the possibility of interpreting the text that way. The text would be saying, okay, we've got a few plans of what we're going to do with this girl who's been purchased. Two kinds of marriages possible. And if she doesn't marry either one of them, then she has to get these basic things provided to her. And then you would be tempted to say, if you read it this way, you would say that lo teitzei ketzeita abadim, she shall not go free as male slaves do, might mean that she can stay there forever, and she can stay there forever without actually having gotten married to. There are three possibilities here, according to this understanding. One of them, this understanding that Ibn Ezra says, lo yitachein, this is an impossible understanding, and that almost all of the commentators within the rabbinic tradition understood it this way. And I was really interested. I opened up just to see what my old teacher, Professor Nachum Sarna, Zichrono Libracha, what he wrote in his commentary on Exodus. And he follows the rabbinic tradition also. So, and you know, he's... Professor Sarna was not afraid to go against the rabbinic tradition. So it's not certain what I'm providing here is really the simplest understanding of the text. Professor Sarna says, following the rabbinic tradition, that the three things are either marrying her off to the son, or sending her back to her nuclear family. Then if you don't do any of those three things, then the court's going to intervene and it's going to send her back to her original family. But if the understanding that everybody's trying to avoid is an understanding that would say here that she could stay there forever as long as she's just given her She'er Ksut and Ona, as long as she's given her food, her clothing, and her Ona. Okay, so that's, those are two ways of reading the pshat of this verse, and the rabbinic tradition lines up unanimously in favor of saying that she cannot stay there forever as a slave. I hope that from last week's session, those of you who were here last week, and from this week's session, you are getting the impression that I think is not to be doubted at all, that the rabbis, when they came to interpret this text, were trying to interpret it in such a way as to increase the rights of this young woman. You know, whenever there were two possibilities of how to interpret the text, whatever was more beneficial to this girl is the interpretation that the rabbis ended up offering to this text. Okay, so that's the first problem with what Ibn Ezra says, it's impossible to offer this this explanation. There's another reason why it's impossible, and the other reason that it's impossible relates to the understanding of the word ona. So this takes us from issue number four back to issue number three. I'm just thinking that maybe before going to the ona issue, I'm just going to look at the chat here and see if there was any question about this. Couldn't v'chi yimkor mean if, not when? Of course, it could mean that, yes. But if also implies that they're not casting any judgment on this. They're not saying he can't do it. And that, if she doesn't please, does he sell her back to her family or just give her back? He's supposed to approach the family and say to the family, in rabbinic understanding of this, he's supposed to approach the family and say, could you give me back some of the money that you received for a purchase, and then I'll give her back to you. Then he's supposed to try to strike a deal with them. What would happen to a male slave if a member of the household wanted to marry him? No, I don't think that the rabbis did not understand. In the standard rabbinic understanding, the male slave is somebody over the age of majority, and the female slave is someone beneath this. So it's a totally different situation. Stated outright, the female slave can be married off to either the owner or his son. What about the owner's father? You know, I think I remember that there's something in the Gemara about that, but I don't remember. An age range of 20 or more years. Okay, Steve says, doesn't the pshat say he must do all three things, but he can't do all of them if they are the traditional understanding? Yes, Steve, that is right. And we are going to address that problem right now. Instead of explaining Steve's question, I'm just going to present the text, and then Steve's question will come will become clear. She'irak suta va'onata lo yigra. He should not withhold her she'er, her food, her ksut, her clothing, or her ona. And we remember the context. It's in a verse that says, if he marries another, I think this is what Steve was referring to. Steve, you can correct me in the chat if you weren't. If he marries another, that means that nobody's marrying her. Then he should not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her ona. Okay, what does ona mean? So Rashi provides us with the standard, okay, Talmudic understanding of the word ona. Let me just say something about the word ona before we read Rashi. For the last 2,000 years, ona has been a very common Hebrew word, and it means that when you use the word ona in modern Hebrew, and it began to mean this in rabbinic times, it means a period of time or a season. The Four Seasons Hotel is called Malon Arba Onot, and we are now in the Ona of spring going into summer. So that's one of the uses of the word Ona, but it could also just be used for anything time-related or periodic in that sense. However, in rabbinic literature, it has a further meaning, which Rashi says, at the bottom of the screen here, onata tashmish. Ona means sexual intercourse. Okay, if he marries another one, he must not withhold from this one her food, her clothing, or her ona. That creates a bit of a problem, and which Rashi solves by saying, if he marries another in addition to her, aleha. So Rashi, of course, assumes if the text is talking about her sexual gratification, her sexual life, then obviously she must be married. So why does the beginning of the verse say, if he marries another one, he should still be providing for the sexual needs of this one? So Rashi, and this is the traditional Jewish understanding of the verse, the traditional Jewish understanding is that it means, this verse means, she can't be treated as a second-class wife. That if she becomes one of more than one wife in this household, somebody, the owner of the household or the son of the owner of the household, will be married to her, but this person could also be married to other, to another woman or to other women. So she can't be treated as the second class wife. She receives all of the, all of what is due to a wife. But that's what the text here is saying, that she gets all that are, that is due for, to a wife. And in rabbinic literature, these terms here, she'er, kasut, ve'ona, are the standard terms that are used to describe the responsibilities of a husband to his wife, the responsibility to provide her with food, to the responsibility to provide her with clothing, and the responsibility to satisfy her sexually. That becomes a standard phrase in rabbinic literature, she'er ksut ba'ona, ona meaning sexual satisfaction. And it even became part of the language of the ketubah. Those of you who are married and have a traditional ketubah hanging on your wall somewhere can go and look at the language of the ketubah. The language of the ketubah says that the man promises to provide to his wife mizonaychi, your food, ksutaychi v'sipukaychi, your clothing and your necessities, umeal levataychi ke'orach kol ara, and I will approach you in the standard manner. As I was doing research on the word ona a few months or maybe more than a year ago, I got in touch with my friend, Professor Robert Brody, who's one of the leading Talmudists in the world today. I said, I just wanted to check with you. Do you agree with me that the phrase me'al alevataychi ke'orach kol ara should be understood as approaching sexually? All it means is, I will walk towards you. I remember I talked about this with some other friends, and they just assumed, oh, it just means that, you know, I'll treat you the way people treat each other, that we'll treat each other nicely, is what it says in the ketubah. But Professor Brody told me that there is no doubt that the reference here is to sexuality. And in fact, in the oldest versions of the ketubah, if you look in the Gaonim, Professor Brody is a particular expert in the Gaonic literature, and if you look in Rambam, it doesn't say me'al lebataychi, it says me'al alaychi, to go upon you, and which Professor Brody pointed out to me, is how Unklus translates the phrase when Lot's daughters say to each other, there's nobody left in the world, lavo aleinu, to have intercourse with us, kederach kol ha'aretz, because all the men have died except for our father, they believe. Unklus translates there, lemeal alana, to come upon us sexually. So this phrase here, she'er ksut ba'ona, became a standard catchphrase in rabbinic law, and it is reflected in the language of the traditional ketubah as being the three essential needs of the woman that have to be provided by her husband. Okay, so that's the standard rabbinic understanding of the word ona. The word ona basically doesn't show up in the Bible. And so we can say that the rabbinic tradition has the right understanding of the word. It could very well be. Or there were a few brave souls who suggested other understandings of the word. just talking before about Rashbam sometimes going against the rabbinic tradition. And here is an example of them going against the rabbinic tradition. Again, just if anybody has any doubt, Rashbam, the great Talmudist, very pious Jew in the 12th century, there's no question that he accepted the idea that from a halachic perspective, a man has the obligation of onah, and onah means the sexual gratification of his wife. But Rashbam says that the pshat is different. Following the plain meaning of scripture, onah means her lodging. Beit dira, lashon ma'on. And then he gives an interesting grammatical explanation. For the letter mem in ma'on, lodging, is a prefix and is not part of the root. Just like the mem at the beginning of the words makom and malon. So makom comes from the verb kuf vav mem. Malon comes from the verb lamed vav nun or lamed yud nun. And ma'on, nobody has any doubts that ma'on means lodging, as in, I give you, for those who could read the Hebrew on the bottom of the left-hand side of the slide, Hashem ahavti ma'on beitecha, the line of Tehillim that became part of the Matovu prayer in the morning. God, I love the dwelling place of your house. So there is a verb, according to Rashbam, un. There's a root called un, ayin vav nun. And often in Hebrew, when you have a root, a verbal root, you can have different kinds of nouns that are constructed from it. Like from kum, akum, to get up, we have makom, meaning a place, and we have koma, meaning height, or the floor of a building. And so from the root un, Rashbam argues you can make two nouns. You can make the noun ma'on, or you can make the noun ona, and they both mean, they both have something to do with lodging. And then Rashbam says, the verse, hare, mazon, uchzut, umador. The verse thus requires providing food, clothing, and shelter. And we think about it, when you talk about giving people their basic needs, food, clothing, and shelter are very often a threesome that we think about. You know, we can't neglect to provide so-and-so with their basic needs, and their basic needs are food, clothing, and shelter. And Rashbam argues that that's what these three words here mean. She'er, ksut, and onah mean food, clothing, and shelter. Rashbam was not the first person in history to offer this this explanation. It was offered by Menachem Ibn Sorek as one of two possibilities. Menachem was a great grammarian who lived 150, 200 years before Rashbam. And Menachem writes that this is one of two ways. He also mentions the standard rabbinic way of understanding the text. And I'm not an expert in Karaite biblical exegesis, but colleagues of mine who are more expert than I in Karaite biblical exegesis say that the Karaites, or some of the Karaites at least, interpreted the word onah in this way. Did Rashbam know anything about the Karaites? There's no reason to think that Rashbam or anybody who lived in France in the 12th century knew anything about the Karaites. The Karaism was doing quite well in other countries, but not in, but certainly not in Ashkenazic countries in those days. Rashbam could have seen this interpretation, though, in the writings of Menachem Ibn Sorek and Menachem's Machmeret, with which he was acquainted. Okay, so that's one alternate explanation. There is another alternate explanation that has gained quite a bit of popularity in modern biblical critical circles, and that is that onah could mean anointing oil. Why do people say this? Because in many texts from cultures around the Israelites. You have three examples here. This is well before the days of the Torah. The laws of King Lippidasher of Sumer from 4,000 years ago. He writes, if a man's wife does not bear him a child, but a prostitute from the street does bear him a child, he shall provide grain, oil, and clothing rations for the prostitute, and the child shall be his heir. So Lippidasher thinks that the three things that a man should be providing to a woman are food, clothing, and oil. And so does Ptahotep, even before that, in Egypt, who writes a book of instructions to young people, said, when you prosper and found your house and love your wife with ardor, fill her belly, clothe her back, anointment soothes her body, gladden her heart as long as you live. So Ptahotep in Egypt also thinks that the three basic things are clothing, food, and ointment. And in the laws of Eshnunna, which is getting a little closer to biblical times, also for the ancient Near East, if a man gives his child for suckling and for rearing, but does not give the food, oil, and clothing rations to the caregiver for 3 years, he shall weigh and deliver 10 shekels of silver. There's a fine. He asks somebody to take care of the kid, and he didn't provide the person who's taking care of the kid with the necessities of life, which are food, clothing, and anointing oil. So if I remember correctly, it was 30 or 40 years ago that somebody came up with this theory and said, we got this Hebrew word in the Bible called onan. We don't know what it means. And so let's say that it means the same thing as it meant in other cultures in the ancient Near East. No one has ever come up with an etymological explanation of why onan would be connected with anointing oil. Rashbam provided an alternate explanation here, and he comes up with an explanation that's based on some grammatical analysis. He comes up with a shorah. The people who advocate for this theory, I'll say this a little bit strong, but the people who advocate for this theory are advocating for it because they just assume that the Hebrew Bible is going to be like the cultures that are around the Hebrew Bible. And if we find this in cultures around the Hebrew Bible, that those are the three things that the man provides to the woman, then let's assume that it means the same thing here. Many of us think differently and think that the Hebrew Bible is actually polemicizing very often against the values of the cultures around them. And so why would we say that just because these cultures think that the three basic things that a woman needs are food, clothing, and anointing oil, why would we say that the Hebrew Bible feels that way? Even Ezra tries to defend the rabbinic understanding of the text. The meaning of her onah is sexual activity, which is also known as the time of lovemaking, eight dodim in Yechezkel. And then he explains, this is good grammatical explanation, the word eight, time, is missing a nun. You look at the word eight, which means time, ayin tuf, and you don't see a nun there. But there's a nun there. And how do I know that there's a nun in the shorash there? There's a missing nun that just got assimilated into the last letter. Because it's similar to the word emet, which comes from amen. That's also solid grammatical analysis, that the root of the word emet, meaning truth, is aleph mem nun. And that is why the tav of eight receives a dagesh as a sign of the assimilated letter. In, for instance, itich, your time, hine itich et dodim. You see, if you're looking at the Hebrew side, itich, there's a dagesh there in the tav. And why is there a dagesh there in the tav? Because of the missing nun. When you just look at the word eight, you can't put a dagesh in the last letter of a word. And so that's why there is no dagesh in et. The dagesh fell out. But when you expand that word itich, or you say ito, as we say in Kriyat Shema every day, if you're saying, next time you're saying the pshat, look at it, and the word ito has a dagesh in the top, and why? Because the root has a nun in it, and so, and also the word ata, meaning right now, has a dagesh in the top, and so we know that all of these words of about time actually really have, in the old history of the language, they have a nun in them, and that nun shows up here in the word ona, and ona means the time of lovemaking. That's Ibn Ezra's suggestion. Samuel David Luzzatto, writing in Italy in the 19th century, comes from a very different world than Ibn Ezra came from back in the 12th century. Chagall was a modernist. Chagall was a romantic, as you will see from this passage here where he talks about the word ona. Omer ani, I say that her ona refers to the duties towards her inasmuch as she is a married woman. And without a doubt, this is a reference to sexual intercourse. He has no doubt that the rabbinic understanding of the text here is the correct understanding of the text. And then, as he often does, he expresses his dismay with Ibn Ezra. He was not a big fan of Ibn Ezra's commentary on the Torah. This explanation is unthinkable, that the Torah would designate a man's relationship with his wife by the term set time. That's what Ibn Ezra says here. Todim means the time of lovemaking, as if there is a schedule for lovemaking, as if there is a schedule for intercourse. Besides, nowhere in the Torah is there any timetable for this matter. Of course, Shabbat knows very well that the Talmud really does talk about the frequency that a married couple should have
intercourse. But Chanel is right that the Torah never got into a discussion of this question. And so why would the Torah be using a word that has something to do with time to discuss intercourse? Chanel says that unthinkable. Ein hadza'at sovalto. I can't tolerate this. Then he goes into a long explanation. Instead of reading it, I'm just paraphrasing for you what he said. He says that ona refers to answering or responding. And that's, of course, the standard meaning of the Hebrew root. Ayin, nun, hey, means to answer or to respond. Answering a need can also be described using the word, using the root ayin nun hey. And he essentially says that the Torah uses this word for sexual behavior because the couple are responding to each other. They're responding to each other's sexual needs. And that's why it's very appropriate to use the root ayin nun hey to describe sexual activity. And then Chagall waxes poetic here
in his description. He gives us a
beautiful modern religious understanding of what sexuality between husband and wife is all about. He writes, in their wisdom and their righteousness, the rabbis saw that a woman is not just a tool. She wasn't created just for a man's benefit and pleasure. Rather, a man and wife are partners who have willingly joined together to help one another in love and friendship. It's nice to see this in a Torah commentary on Exodus chapter 21, an attitude towards a modern attitude towards marriage that I think that we can all identify with. And then he goes on and says, not only were the rabbis careful to prevent a man from diminishing his wife's due, the rabbi, he said, we saw before that he said, the Torah never talks about the frequency of sexuality. He says that the rabbis did get into discussions about the frequency of sexuality, but they weren't only concerned about frequency. Not only were the rabbis careful to prevent a man from diminishing his wife's due chok, the frequency that is required, but they were also careful about the finer details that a man should not diminish his wife's pleasure. And then he cites a couple of Talmudic texts that show that the Talmud understands that a man should be aware of and responding to his wife's sexual needs. And then he attacks various attitudes to sexuality that he finds unacceptable. So the first one that he's going to attack two other attitudes to sexuality that he finds to be unacceptable. The first one, I think, is not surprising. In contrast to this, in other words, in contrast to the correct Jewish attitude to sexuality on the one hand, is the behavior of men who are villains, who seek nothing but their own pleasure, always searching for licentiousness, men who look at their own wives with disgust, abandoning them to be agunot in living widowhood. People who get married and are not interested in their sexuality being confined to their wife, but are always looking for other sexual patterns. They've got this wife at home, and she's just there in an aguna in living widowhood. She's married, but she's abandoned by her husband. Okay, so this is the first unacceptable attitude to sexuality that Shadal says goes against the rabbinic tradition. And then, surprisingly enough, he says what the other attitude to sexuality is that he finds to be totally unacceptable. In contrast, on the other hand, is behavior of those wise men, the mitchakmim. So mitchakmim here might very well mean philosophers. The people who think that they're really smart, these wise men who relate to their wives as handmaidens to serve them and as a tonic to keep them healthy. And then he quotes from the Rambam. He doesn't write the word Rambam here, but he assumes that you will recognize that this quotation here is from the Rambam. One should not engage in intercourse unless he finds that his body is exceedingly healthy and strong. The passage that he quotes from the Rambam, from Hilchot Te'ot, really does describe sexual intercourse as something that is, you know, a tonic for men. It makes men feel better. And of course, Rambam was a man, and he's writing from the perspective of a man. And he writes that a man should have intercourse only when he needs to have intercourse. And instead of, as Shadal says, that, you know, that intercourse is responding to the needs of the other partner, and not just to your own needs. And Shadal, if I am right that mitchakmim here means philosophers, Shadal knows very well that Rambam's attitudes towards sexuality were influenced by the philosophic tradition, and that a lot of what Rambam says about sexuality is not really from ancient Jewish sources, but it's from Aristotle. Aristotle talks about the fact that of all the senses, the sense of feeling and touch is the most degraded of all the senses. And Aristotle sees sexuality as connected with the sense of touch, and the all of the other senses, taste and sight, etc., are according to Aristotle of a higher level, and the human being shouldn't be so concerned about things that relate to touch, according to Aristotle's understanding. And Chagall finishes off here with a little punch
here at Rambam, and he writes, "The man whose Torah is the Torah of Moses and the Mishnah and the Talmud loves his wife as much as he loves his own body,
and he honors her more than he honors himself." I think that this is, again, as I said, a little punch at Rambam here. Torah Tohi, Torah Moshe. Of course, Rambam is also Moshe, Moshe ben Maimon. But if Rambam was really really promoting the Torah of Moshe, then he would not have written the things that he wrote about sexuality. And that's how Chagall explains the idea behind the text here. Professor Sarna writes in his commentary on Exodus, "The rabbinic explanation of what Onah means here would reflect a singular recognition in the laws of the ancient Near East that a wife is legally entitled to sexual gratification." Professor Sarna is not convinced that Onah means sexual gratification. He doesn't rule it out as a possibility, but he says, if that is the meaning here, then this is the only place where we can find in the ancient Near East the idea that a husband is legally required to provide his wife with sexual gratification. And I would add that even if we don't say that that's pshat in this text, it is, without any doubt, it is the pshat in rabbinic literature from 2,000 years ago. It was the approach of rabbinic literature from 2,000 years ago. And that in and of itself was already a great innovation, that the description that the requirements from a Jewish husband are to sexually gratify his wife. I think that we have something to be proud of in our tradition, that well before modern times, well before the days of a romantic like Chagall in the 19th century, you can find that that's what rabbinic literature is saying. Okay, I'm going to take a look at the chat now, see what's doing here. Someone suggests, could Onah mean monthly period? I don't think that it could mean that, although the word Onah is used in the halachic literature in relationship to some of the details of the laws of Nidah, but I don't think it means the monthly period. Would a first wife who was not originally a slave have the same rights? I too am thinking Rachel, who after all was supposed to be a first wife. Yes, I'm sure that she would, that the idea is that she would have those rights. If sheltered, then she remains a slave permanently, Steve writes. Yes, right, if that's what it means, that could be what the text is saying. All he has to do is provide her with food, clothing, and shelter. Is that what Rashbam is saying that the text originally meant on the pshat level? He doesn't say that when he gets to the next verse, though. We saw that when he gets to the next verse, Ve'im Shlosh Ela, that if these three things are not done for her, he does not say that that is the case. But you are right, Steve, that could be what one would extrapolate from that interpretation. Lodging, she resides in the main house, not the barn or designated slave quarters, could mean that. Does Rashi follow Rav Gershom on polygamy in the Ashkenazi community? Of course he does. However, he explains the text according, he understands, he has a historical sense that the text was written before the days of Rabbeinu Gershom. Doesn't the Pshat say that he must do all three things, but he can't do all of them if they are the traditional understanding? Yes, Steve, that is the problem of Ona, depending on what Ona means. Might mitchakmin be smart, Alex? Shalom. Yes, it could very well be know-it-alls, free thinkers, but I think that from the continuation there, it's obvious that he means the Rambam. Would he be using the word smart aleck to describe the Rambam? He was not a big fan of a lot of things in the Rambam's worldview, but I'm not sure that he'd use the word smart aleck, but it is surprising to find the freedom with which he expresses himself about Rambam in this text, expresses himself pretty strongly and clearly. Okay, we are finished for now with slaves. And I promise that next week we will go on to the next verses. We'll go on to something much more pleasant. We'll go on to homicide. That's the next topic that that shows up in Parshat Mishpatim, and that will be our theme next week.
More than 600,000 people have already started their claim with us. Simply visit our site now to check your vehicle's eligibility instantly. It's free to sign up.
Nice seeing you all. See you next week. Thank you for coming, and all the best.